This is Johnny Wu, and welcome to Aim High ELI, a podcast series brought to you by the Association of Asian American Investment Managers, better known as AIM. This podcast series is focused on raising the profile of emerging leaders that aspire to become the next generation of leaders in the investment management industry. AIM's Emerging Leaders Initiative, ELI, exists to help Asian American and Pacific Islanders, AAPIs, break the bamboo ceiling, analogous to the glass ceiling faced by women. Although Asians are well represented at the junior ranks across the industry, those statistics drop off precipitously at the senior ranks. We are grateful to our guests for spending time to support AIM High ELI, and we hope our efforts will make an impact over time.
Support for this podcast was made possible by Ovada Capital, which was founded by James Chen, who was featured on episode 4 of the AIM High ELI podcast series. Ovada Capital is a Pan-Asia-focused equity multi-strategy hedge fund with over $750 million in assets under management as of June 2021. Their flagship fund seeks to generate absolute returns with low beta and low correlation to equity markets and hedge funds by pursuing arbitrage, relative value, event, and long-short equity strategies. We thank Ovada for their sponsorship of AIM and wish them continued success. Our guest for today's podcast is Pooja Malik, CEO and founding partner of Nippon Capital. Pooja founded Nippon Capital in 2011 after a very successful career at Barclays Global Investors, BGI, where she was promoted quickly to become one of the youngest managing directors at the firm after successfully turning around BGI's active small cap equity strategy. I very much enjoyed interviewing Pooja, given she has been a perennial underdog all her life, but has tackled every conceivable obstacle and overcome them by leaps and bounds. As the middle child and daughter of a strong Indian mother who raised her family as a single parent after the death of her father when Pooja was just 12, Pooja learned a lot about grit and determination from her mother. As a woman and minority, Pooja is a role model and an inspiration for all of us in the AIM community. I'm so happy she believed enough in herself to launch her own hedge fund almost 10 years ago and took the time to share her story with us. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Pooja Malik. So Pooja, welcome to the AIM High ELI podcast series. I'm very excited to have you today join our podcast. You have all the ingredients in terms of, you know, I don't want to compare you to being a recipe, but if I were in an allocator seat, being a woman, being ethnically diverse, starting your own firm, and then hiring folks and surrounding yourself with an awesome team, I pull for people like that. And when you and I first met and you had reached out, I said, wow, Pooja is like the bomb and I really need to get to know her a bit more. So welcome again to the podcast and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Johnny. And thank you for your kind words.
Oh yeah, sure, sure. So you're a strong, confident, independent woman, but let's start from the beginning because everybody has a story. So I think upbringing is really important. You're from India initially before coming to the U.S., but talk a bit about your early days and your early influences.
Like you said, I was born and brought up in India, and I think one of the sort of early influences in my life and the role model for me was my mom. My father passed away when I was 12, and so I was brought up pretty much by a single mom. In those days in India, even today actually, given gender inequality, it was hard for my mom as a single mother to bring up three daughters. And my mom had never worked in her life. She had never driven a car. So I really got to see how much drive, motivation, and grit can do for you. Because she went from being stay-at-home, so a very domesticated person, to I've got to do everything to make sure my kids can succeed. And that lesson of grit and perseverance has always stuck with me.
Wow. So your mom must be a very strong woman. And so she had never worked before. And then after your dad had passed, then she had to kind of enter the workforce there. And especially whether it's India or other societies, you know, there's some societies today where women can't even drive cars. So I think about India, very male dominated. What was that like? I mean, did she talk to you a lot about her perseverance and her struggles? Like, why didn't she try to get remarried? And I don't know if she did, but it's more of a question.
Yeah, she did not. And I think a lot of that is cultural. We were very young. Like I was 12 and my younger sister was only 6. My older sister was 13. So she did not talk to us. I think we were not old enough for us to really comprehend what she was going through. And culturally also in India, there's not an environment where you talk to kids about the hard things in life, at least at that time. So she did not, but we saw it, Johnny. You know, so much about parenting is role models. So we saw it, even though she didn't talk to us. We knew what she was going through. And we know the sacrifices she made for each of us.
Yeah. She must be very, very inspiring for you, et cetera. So I'm curious. So you go through the educational system in India. I haven't heard of your undergraduate college before. Well, a lot of my Indian friends who are mostly men. It's like, if you're not in IIT school, then it's just like, so talk to me a bit about that. Like, were you an underdog even in your early college years as well too? Help educate me. I'm the type of person that if I didn't get into Harvard, my parents were like, oh, you kind of failed. You went to Columbia, but what is that? So talk to me a bit about that.
You're totally on point. Because when I was in high school, so in India, after 10th grade, you have to decide whether you're going to choose to study sciences, business, or liberal arts. And when I was going to school, all the top performing students chose to study science. And if you were in the middle of the group, you studied business. And if you were bottom of the class, you studied liberal arts. And that's how the system worked. So when it was my time to decide, I wanted to study business. My dad was an entrepreneur. It wasn't me. It's what I wanted to do. But my teachers and my family, like everybody thought I should study sciences because I was a good student. So you're very right. I think from the beginning, maybe it was the underdog thing, like you said, but I was clear that I didn't want to do just what society expected me to do. I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And so that's how I ended up studying business, even from my undergrad.
Got it. Okay. And then you decide directly after undergrad to go to business school and get your MBA.
Yes. And that was common in India in those days. So when I went to get my MBA at the Indian Institute of Management in Bangalore, maybe only 30% of the class had work experience.
Got it. Okay. And your first job working for ICICI, your title on your LinkedIn profile is Credit and Relationship Officer, but you were actually managing a credit portfolio then.
Yes. My first job out of my MBA program was at ICICI Bank, which was a terrific learning opportunity for me. I managed a loan portfolio of about $150 million across 20 clients. And these old world clients, Johnny. So my clients were in real estate, in LNG plants, in chemical plants, polyester plants, sugar, cement, autos. So I really got to see how real world things work. And we were giving them project financing, working capital, debt. So think of it as sort of a very diversified credit portfolio. But I got to do everything. I got to do the investment diligence. I got to do the relationship management. And that for me was a terrific experience.
Okay. And then the transition, I know there was a stop at the Indian School of Business before you moved to the U.S. I'm very curious because oftentimes the way for opportunity, right, a lot of really smart Indian expats that come to the U.S., they apply for graduate school, whether it's the sciences or an MBA program, engineering program. So you didn't take that path, although you did get exposed to some of it. So talk to me about that process and leading up to coming to the U.S.
Yeah, that's also a very long story. But the short version of it is I had a really good education, Johnny. So I didn't feel the need to come here to get another master's. And I think a lot of the reason people do that is for the network, not so much for the education. And I was too young to understand the power of network at that time. So I felt like I didn't need another master's degree. The way I moved here was that in those days, which was the height of the tech bubble in 99 and early 2000s, there was a U.S. financial services firm that was looking to hire talent out of India. And they gave me an offer. But by the time things materialized and I moved here, the bubble had crashed and that firm had gotten acquired 2 times over. And pretty much as soon as I came here, I didn't have a job. And so that's when I found my role at Barclays Global Investors, and I joined them in February of 2001.
That sounds a little bit like a disaster. In terms of, it's great that you ended up at BGI, but the stress around getting sponsorship toward a green card, I'm sure, et cetera, how did that play out? I mean, were you in fear of, okay, these guys are no longer honoring their commitment because of the dot-com crash? What was that like then?
I think the most interesting part of it was the experience of getting laid off and not having a job. Because culturally in India, in those days especially, I mean, there was no concept of getting laid off. So when you said you were laid off, people hear it as you got fired, and that's terrible. And so I think that whole transition was an interesting experience, but I never sort of, I wasn't scared because my husband was here as well and he had an independent job. So I didn't really have as much of a visa problem. Financially, we were okay because we still had one income. So I think that really helped. And I found this job at BGI pretty quickly. It probably took me a couple of months. And I actually had multiple offers at that time. So I think all in all, it worked out well.
Okay. So you were married already. So what was the catalyst for coming to the U.S.? Did he have a great job here that he landed, or was it your opportunity or a combination of those?
It was actually my opportunity. I got the offer to move here, and we decided between the two of us that it would be really great experience and exposure for us. Because at that point, a lot of my experience was in India. And my husband had grown up in different parts of the world, but most of his working experience was also in India. And we thought for ourselves, from a career perspective, from a development perspective, how great would it be to go and spend a couple of years in the U.S.? So that's sort of how it came about. But it was my job offer that precipitated the move.
Got it. Okay. That doesn't surprise me because I'm sure we'll get into it. Like independent-minded female founder, I'm sure you have a lot of grit and confidence as well, too, which you need in this business. So you land your job at BGI. Talk to me about your growth and development there.
My first job there was in the corporate strategy and finance team because I had the finance background. And it was a small team. We were only maybe 4 or 5 people, which really gave me an opportunity to do a lot, see a lot, contribute, but also learn. And my direct manager, she was the CFO of the organization. She was a very strong mentor to me, even to this day. She's been absolutely fabulous in supporting my career. Being part of the corporate strategy team, Johnny, meant that I could see what was going on in the entire organization, where we made money, where we had challenges, what really was the core expertise that we were good at. So I think early in your career, being able to have that exposure is fantastic. At the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned advice for women or people that are earlier in their career. And I think this is a fantastic takeaway for a lot of people is early in your career, having broad exposure is fantastic because then you get to figure out really what your passion is.
Right. I was talking to someone a few weeks ago and this person was at Morgan Stanley and they were in the sales and trading program and they were doing really well. And then someone like a James Gorman plucked her out and into corporate strategy so that she can get a wider lens of the organization.
Yes.
And then thereafter got to cherry pick like the growth areas, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's usually a reward for star performers. And then you happen to land this job as your first job within BGI. And that's terrific. And this is not to be confused with the ETF business. You're on the more institutional side, what BGI historically has known as like the quant business, if you will. So making that transition, you spend a couple of years in corporate strategy, and then did you raise your hand and say, hey, I want to learn to be a PM? Like, how did that work out there?
My 2 years in the corporate strategy team were really fantastic because, like I said, the exposure and the opportunity to build senior level relationships. Because all the projects the corporate strategy team did either were directly for the CEO or for the CIO or the head of distribution. So I got to build a lot of senior relationships. I did that job for 2 years and then I was ready to move on. I was not a career consultant. I really wanted to do things and build and get my hands dirty. And after 2 years, I was done and I was looking to move out. And at that point, a lot of my senior colleagues that I had gotten to know said, why don't you explore opportunities within the firm? The only thing we did really well was manage money. So we did a lot of other things. But I think there were a lot of other organizations that were also good at client service, at marketing, at operations, at technology. But Barclays Global Investors, BGI, we were really good at managing money. And so I said, well, if I'm going to do anything, that's what I want to do here, because that's the thing we do really, really well. And so I started to explore opportunities on the research team. Now, that was also an interesting transition because, as you mentioned, the firm was known for quantitative investing. And everybody on the research team had a PhD. Everybody was a quant, and I wasn't. I had never managed a single dollar in equity assets. I knew very little about statistics. I could not write code. And so it was a transition, but I think it was a very supportive environment, Johnny. I literally went to the head of research and I said, give me an opportunity. Let me do it for a year. If it doesn't work, I'll leave. Like, I don't want to spend my life doing something that I'm not going to be good at. But if it works, we can reevaluate and take it from there. And for me, it was such a big turning point in my career because not only did it work, I loved it. I loved what I did. I learned every part of the business. I learned to scrub data. I learned to write code. I think that opportunity that I got really changed my life.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because you weren't going to be a better coder than the folks that studied computer science and they were gurus. You weren't going to be a better data scrubber than the folks that like naturally manipulate data from an early age. But learning the nuts and bolts of that is really important to kind of inform the process in terms of understanding running an overall business. But certainly you can't be bad at it as well, too. So I'm sure you were very, very good at it. What was that like then? Like, how did you learn that? And I hate to sound like an elitist. Did these PhD and quant gurus look at you and say, okay, this business degree person, can she handle it? Like, why are we giving her a shot? There's a little subculture in that. I know BGI is a very supportive organization, but like, there's still a little bit of that.
And it was a very academic organization. So I think as long as you were intellectually rigorous and intellectually honest, then you got a lot of support. Maybe there were people that thought like that, Johnny, but I was too young to care. I actually had no concept of the outside world. I just did what I did. And I think it was one of those phases in my life where the less I knew, the better it was. Because I'm sure people had these biases, but I was totally clueless about the bias in the workplace. I just put my head down and I got things done. To your point of, yes, this was nitty gritty, but I had to do the nitty gritty to just build credibility in the organization.
You must have done something really right, because for them to graduate you, right, from being in research to being actually a portfolio manager, that's a big step as well, too. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah, that was really all thanks to Dr. Charles Lee, who's now my partner at Nippon. He joined BGI as a global head of research, and he was putting together a global team to look at all of the various strategies. And he picked me to be on the team because I think he wanted a different point of view. That experience was really, again, fantastic for me, Johnny, because now even though I was in research, I got to see equity strategies across the firm globally and be part of a global review team. I got to travel, which in those days was a luxury, so that was nice. And I think as part of that process and the exposure I got, I realized that I really loved the portfolio management piece of it. Again, it's more accountability. It's more concrete. The timeline is different. And I really, really love that. And I think Charles saw in me the potential to take on a portfolio management role.
And you were a portfolio manager, and you had shared that you were one of the youngest managing directors as well within BGI. How did that kind of come across among your peers? Did people look at you in awe in terms of she's a superstar, or what was that like?
So when I got this opportunity to be on the portfolio management team, this was for a strategy that had been struggling for the last 3 years. So it was a turnaround situation. The great thing about being in a turnaround situation, Johnny, is like you get a lot of freedom because from the outside, people think everything is broken. So you can only do better. Because, you know, if you go to a product that's performing very well, then nobody wants you to change anything. But this product, they had a difficult stretch and they really wanted someone to come in and turn it around. And I did with my team. My team was exceptional even then. I had a team of 6 people. We turned around the strategy. We made a bunch of really radical changes. But I think that laid the groundwork for my promotion to managing director.
Got it. And that was the active U.S. small cap strategy?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So you're no longer at BGI, not at BlackRock. What was the kind of the difference in performance? Were you underperforming your benchmark by a couple hundred basis points and the turnaround was the result of that you were outperforming by a couple hundred basis points then? In broad strokes, is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely, yeah.
So how did you do that then?
We structurally sort of evaluated every piece of the investment process. So for a quant manager, Johnny, you probably know this, we're model driven. So the key parts of our models are there's an expected return model that's forecasting an expected return for every stock. There's an expected risk model that's forecasting risk for every stock. And there's a transaction cost model. And then the ultimate portfolio is an outcome of how these stocks rank on these three models, the expected return model, the risk model, and the transaction cost model. So with my team, I revamped each part of these models. So we looked at the expected return model, and we found that it was a good model, but was not really tailored for U.S. small cap stocks. So small cap stocks trade very differently from large cap stocks, which sounds obvious. But I think the big difference is that large cap stocks trade, or at least in those days, traded really on fundamentals. Because large cap stocks have reasonably forecastable cash flows. You can say what the next 3-year cash flow is going to be. But for small cap stocks, these are very high growth, high failure rates. So small cap stocks really traded more on investor sentiment. And so we redid the models in a way that made them more relevant for the small cap model. And so that's why we felt very good about what we did, because we turned around performance, but we also structurally laid the foundation for success.
And were you the named portfolio manager where you were the lead and then you had a 6-person team then that worked on all three of those components? Okay. Did you have to fire anyone when you did that? Was that decision already made and they were changing the team, whether they fired or took away responsibility and said, hey, you're a large cap person, go do that. We're going to give Pooja this responsibility to see if she can turn this thing around.
I was lucky that somebody else did that for me. So I did not have to fire anybody.
So you got to pick the 6 people on your team as well too, or you inherited some folks then?
I inherited some folks, and some of the people on the team were way senior than I was. But I think the fact that I had built the credibility on the research side and people had seen my contributions, I think that just made it a lot easier.
That's amazing. Usually it's you're younger, you're a woman, and you're not American. And it's like, who is this person? Right? She's from research and she's smart. But is she going to be the person that turns around the portfolio? But you did it.
I did it. And Johnny, I was at that point becoming more aware of the environment around me. There were people on my team that got paid more than me. But I didn't really care. Like, I was there for the learning. I wanted to have impact. And coming from a very middle-class background in India, I was getting paid more than I ever thought I was going to make in my life. So I wasn't worried about people on my team getting paid more than I was or having less resources. I didn't care about that stuff. I really just wanted to have impact.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'm going to digress a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about family as well too. So do you have children, if I can ask?
Sure, yeah. I have 2 young kids. They're 10 and 12, 2 boys.
Okay, so during your BGI years, they weren't around yet. You were like head down. Like, were you working like nonstop 7 days a week? And talk to me about that.
That's a great question. I was. And now I look back and I think in my younger days, I should have had more fun. Because as you get older, travel is harder. There's more constraints. So now I look back and I think, what was I thinking? Because I literally work 24/7. But Johnny, I think that has served me well. I think the amount I learned in those years, it was like drinking from a fountain. And so it was right place, right time. But I think I also really, really made the most of that opportunity that I had. I just learned a tremendous amount in those years. And if I hadn't put in the hours, I would not be where I am.
It was your time. That's the way that I think about it, right? You're in the zone, you're grooving. And in fact, as you get older, you get smarter, you can still have as much, if not more impact, but you don't have to do it with as many hours as well, because you're just so much wiser and smarter. So through 2008, you're at BGI, soon to become BlackRock, when Barclays so smartly sold the BGI business to BlackRock. Talk to me about 2008. Because everyone had a drawdown then and just managing through the GFC then.
Yeah, in 2008, I was still in charge of the U.S. small cap portfolios and they still did well. I was also co-heading our U.S. large cap business at that point, and that was a huge responsibility because it was a very large portfolio. In 2008, when the global financial crisis hit, we did have difficult performance, but I think we were still way ahead of the competitive landscape, and that helped. I think the biggest impact then was just the fact that we had to restructure the business. So you had asked earlier if I ever had to fire people, and I didn't have to do that in my early years. But after the global financial crisis, as a firm, we decided to downsize, and I had to let some people on my team go. So I think that was the hardest thing at that point.
All right. Okay, and then you managed through the crisis through the end of 2010, at which point you leave BlackRock at that point in time. and then decide to start your own business. What's the story behind that? Because for a large part of our audience, it's folks that aspire to be like you, right? To launch their own business. Easy to say, very hard to do, because everyone wants a check in hand before they do it, enough revenue to cover all their operating costs. It just doesn't happen. But talk to me about your decision there. Why did you do it? What were you thinking?
You're exactly right, Johnny. I think for me, this is where having the financial support from my husband made a huge difference. I think as I look back at my cohort of people that went to school with me, I think the difference in people that have been successful and not has been their risk-taking ability. People that have taken risk have done extremely well. And people that haven't have done okay too. And I think I was in that group of people where I was doing well, but it was time for me to take risk and do something different. And I was in a place where I could take risk because I had financial support and stability. I had content knowledge. I had a team. It was just a bunch of things coming together. It was, again, right place, right time, right opportunity. And I wanted to do something entrepreneurial.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. When I took my shot, and I did it a lot later in my career to start my own business, et cetera, and I love my wife, and my wife does an awesome job in terms of, like, now that I'm home all the time, I see, like, how much work she does. I'm just like, my kids are just, they always go to mom. I'm like, come to me, they're like that. You don't know. But she does so much. But having said that, having been the primary breadwinner over the course, et cetera, like, for me to have taken that shot earlier in my career, if I failed, it was a significant change in lifestyle. So I do appreciate it. So having, whether it's a supportive husband or a wife, dual income so that you can take the shot, that does help quite a bit because you have to manage the overall risk of your family as well too.
Completely, completely. And in fact, when my husband was going through his career transition, I was very stable at BGI, doing really well. So we kind of supported each other during the process. And you're right. It's just a practicality. It made a huge difference.
And so what type of advice did you get then? So you've decided that you're going to leave BGI. What was the advice that you got from people? Oh, don't worry, Pooja. You're a woman. You've got good returns. You got this great turnaround story. Youngest MD. You're going to like turn on the lights and the billions are going to start coming in. BGI, great pedigree. The reality is very different. But what was the advice that you got? And what was really, really surprising to you when you started doing that? Or maybe you already knew, hey, this thing is going to, you think it's going to take a year? It's going to take 5 years. People say that. Experienced people that have gotten through it. Talk to me about that.
No, people told me don't do it. People said it's not going to work. 9 out of 10 startups fail. Don't do it. And I just didn't believe it, John, because I'm based in Silicon Valley. I'm seeing these 20-year-olds get funded and I'm like, you've never run this product before. You know nothing about this technology. How did somebody just give you $100 million? Like, I can't reconcile this. And I looked at myself and like, I've been doing this for 10 years. I know what I'm doing. I got it. That disconnect, I just didn't reconcile those two things. That disconnect was very large. So even though people kept telling me don't do it, I just couldn't comprehend why it would not work. Because I was thinking, I have a great team, which I really do. I have a really interesting investment thesis. My track record is proven. The investment philosophy is proven. I could see no reason why it wouldn't work. So I just took the punch and I jumped in.
Yeah. Well, as many people say, right, if you don't believe in yourself, why should anyone else believe in you? So you did it. And that's great. And so talk to me about the formation of the team, the naming of the organization. I think it's very cute, skilled and standing on a strong foundation. Talk to me about that all coming together for you.
The name Nippon has very interesting origins. It's actually a Sanskrit word, which means skill or agility, and has a close translation in Chinese, which means standing on a solid rock or a solid foundation. To us at Nippon, these two things really embody what we do. We think about our investment approach as being grounded in a solid foundation. Our principles of investing have been around for a long time. They've been tested over decades, and those are foundational to us. And then what we do is we apply these foundational principles with tactical agility and skill to every individual market that we invest in. So the word Nippon really brings together our investment approach, which is standing on a solid foundation and then applying those principles with skill in each market that we invest in.
The forming of the team was relatively easy because I knew so many people and I worked so closely with the current investors at Barclays Global Investors. So I really knew people, Johnny, from a cultural perspective as well, because I'd been there 10 years. So I was able to really handpick the team. And I think the two critical team members for me were my partners, Dr. Charles Lee and Dr. Ken Hui. And we really complement each other very, very well. Because I had shifted to portfolio management. So for my last 5 years at BGI, I was on the portfolio management side. My partner, Ken, was always on the research side. He has a PhD from MIT. He had worked at Barra, which is a risk modeling firm. So he covers an important role at Nippon and one that I had just grown out of. And, you know, I hadn't done research in a long time. So that was a very important complement. And our third partner, Dr. Charles Lee, he was the global head of equity research at BGI. But personally, he was my mentor as well. He had gone on to become a professor at Stanford. And he's done very well since then. And I wanted him because of the values and sort of the guidance that he gave me throughout my career. The cultural piece was very important for me. But also, he brought a different perspective coming from academia. One of the things is, and you know this, when you start a small firm, you don't have the team of 50 researchers. And so for me, he was the bridge to having a broad academic network to be in the flow of ideas, to see things. So I think that bringing the team together, again, I was lucky, it was right place, right time. Ken and Charles were also looking to do something more active. So it really worked out.
So how did you convince them to join you with you being the majority owner and the leader of the firm? I think it's great. Like at this stage in my life, I want to work with awesome people and that person's like 10 years my junior, great. Because it's their time, if you will. And if I could help accelerate that, it gives me a lot of career fulfillment to see someone else successful and it's their time. So like the analogy, so let's say you're Michael Jordan and you're later in your career. Like you can't be the number one guy or gal, but then you want to be working with someone that's championship caliber. So talk to me about that.
I think it's exactly that, what you said, which is that both Charles and Ken are more senior in their career than I am. And I think they were at that point where they want to do good work. They want to work on interesting problems. They want to see other people succeed, but they don't necessarily want to be the person running the show. And I actually offered Charles when we started this to go just 50-50 and have an equal partnership, but he didn't want to do it. And I think it's a lot of what you said, the ability to take risk and being where you are in your career. But now looking back, it's worked out really well for us.
Well, it speaks a lot to who you are as an individual, because I'm sure they want to follow you, even though you are less experienced, but your trajectory and that they viewed you as a superstar to do this. It's amazing. And look, there's pros and cons to all that, right? As well, too. Like, I wound down for, it's not fun, but like, you need someone to kind of be able to kind of stick through it throughout the entire process and life cycle of everything. And investors want to know that as well, too. So.
And I think the fact that we had a relationship and we'd known each other for 10 years really helped, Johnny, because they know that even though I'm running the firm, they have a very, very influential voice in what happens at Nippon. And there's that trust there. That really helped.
So talk to me about the first dollar in, right? You don't have to tell me the investor, but what was that process like? Did it take a lot longer than you thought? Was it who you thought would give you money, right? Because oftentimes who you think is going to give you money ends up not being that person as well, too. What was that like in the early days when you're starting Nippon then?
The first dollar in was me, Charles, and Ken. So, you know, like you said earlier, if you don't believe in yourself, who will? So we did. And that was the first dollar in. And then we raised money from friends and family. I got a lot of support from people I didn't know at all. So you're totally right. You just don't know who's going to support you. But they were people, Johnny, that had never seen me that invested in the fund. So day one, we launched with only about 20 million in assets and half of that was partner money.
Got it. So you really bootstrapped it. And partner money, friends and family to develop a track record outside of BGI. At what point did you actually start getting institutional money from that first $20 million then? Because oftentimes people say, okay, don't call me until you're $100 million. Don't call me until you have a 3-year track record. And then some people that like you may say, okay, make that 1 year. But talk to me about that.
I think one of the things we did early on when we were founding the firm was that we raised working capital for the management company, Johnny. Because I had it in my head that it takes 3 years to build a track record. So I wasn't expecting to raise a lot of money very quickly. And having that working capital gave us a lot of cushion. But I think, again, we were right place, right time. The strategy did exceedingly well. So we grew from 20 to 40 with just friends and family money. But then when we were at $40 million, we raised a founder share clause. And we went from 40 to 100 through two big fund of fund investors that cared about the fees. And then once we were at a one-year track record, we were at $100 million. And then that allowed more institutional investors to come in. So we just grew from there on.
Now, when you and I first met and you reached out and were learning about each other, one thing you said to me was actually really interesting was around networking. Like networking is, it's actually hard, and I'm still not a great networking as well too. And especially culturally as well too, because you were brought up in India and yes, you've lived in the US the better part of 20 plus years right now. Networking is work. It is work, right? Talk to me about your appreciation of networking now and what do you think about networking in general?
Super important skill to have. And you're right, it's work and you have to work it and you have to activate those muscles in your brain because it's so important. And I think in terms of advice for people that are younger and starting out, there's always an opportunity to build a network along the way. And I didn't do it for the first 15 years of my career. But today I look back and those were just missed opportunities, Johnny. So today, like when I go for an event, it's not there just for fun. Like I used to think these are just the corporate boondoggle events. But now I've realized like there's real work in building a network. And you also, you just never know when anybody is going to be helpful or when you can help somebody. So a lot of networking is just getting to know people. You're right. It's hard work, but I think it's work that at some point in time pays off. It's all good karma in the system. People that helped me 10 years ago are people I never thought they would. And then a lot of the younger women that I've helped over my career, I'm sure they'll repay it back in some way, shape or form. But I think it's important when you go into an event or into a networking opportunity to have very clear goals of what do I want to get out of. And maybe all you want to get out of it is talk to three people you haven't talked to before. Just easy goals, but to be very intentional about networking.
Yeah. I too didn't realize that late in my career. When I look back to my college years or my first 5 to 10 years out of school, because it was work, because you want to hang out with your friends, or at that point I was dating and it was just different priorities. And I never put that as a top priority until I realized later in my career, I didn't do it. Oh, I need to network, but you can get so much more done if you have a stronger network. But the one thing I always say is if you're walking in a hallway, say hello first. And part of that is more of if you build your network and just extend the hand and try to help people, that person may not repay you for that. But that whole karma thing, and I'm a believer of that, that does come back to be helpful over the long term. That's my view. So let's talk about why does the world need Nuplin Capital? What is your competitive advantage and why do investors need someone like you?
Nuplin is focused on Asia and emerging markets. I had this thesis 10 years ago when we started Nuplin that there was a structural flow of funds and growth in Asia and emerging markets. And the numbers and the data show this too. If you look at how much Asia has grown in terms of its contribution to world GDP, emerging markets are half of the world and 60% of global growth is coming from this part of the world. So I think institutions need more exposure to this part of the world. But the reason they need Nuplin is because we deliver a very pure, uncorrelated alpha stream from these markets. So our strategy is zero beta for the most part. We also have a long-only strategy, which of course has beta. But our core alpha engine is what I would call very pure alpha, so uncorrelated returns. And I think that's very distinctive in the marketplace today, Johnny. I also attribute that to my BGI upbringing. Because BGI was very big on this concept of alpha-beta separation, which today I don't know if really clients care so much. I think people just care about total returns. But this idea that alpha is alpha and priced as such and beta is beta and priced as such, I think that idea was very ingrained in us. So Nuplin is all about delivering pure alpha to institutional investors.
Nuplin has all the ingredients that it takes to deliver this pure alpha stream. Our team has deep investment expertise over decades. Our investment approach has stood the test of time. And we are taking this investment approach and applying it in a very contextualized manner to the markets in Asia and EM, which are high alpha markets. So all in all, I think the world needs Nippon to be able to deliver this pure alpha stream from these complex and ever-changing markets.
And if you think about, so I'm going to put my business school hat on and pretend like I'm working as you as a strategist. And my pure objective is help you raise a lot of AUM to make you a more profitable business, right? Now, of course, the counter to that as a PM, you care a lot more about alpha. You don't want to be like just an asset gatherer. But if we think about that, as Warren Buffett says, forget all this shorting, right? Like the big piece you want to solve is the long only portfolio. And even if it's lower fees, you're going to have multiple times in terms of AUM. So from a business perspective, that is what you should focus on. Now, the art of market neutral or low beta and a pure alpha, there's a lot of value to that, right? Because when institutions separate beta from alpha, as you talk about, the really sophisticated institutional investors, like the CPPs, the Wisconsins, those folks, they love that kind of stuff, right? And they can write you big tickets and make a big difference as well, too. But if I think about emerging markets, like how big can that really be versus just doing long-only emerging market, China, Asia, which you're good at as well? How do you think about those two things then?
Johnny, you started the question saying if I was a strategist for you. So I just want to put it out there. That would be terrific. But to your second point, how big can they be? I think in the market neutral space, capacity is limited. I think in that capacity, in that strategy, we can probably manage somewhere around $750 million to $1 billion. So it's small. But I think the alpha engine is extremely high quality. Like I said, it's pure uncorrelated return. So it's a good business to have even at that size. On the long only side, the main reason we launched the long only strategy was to be able to work with larger institutional investors. Because like you said, a lot of the sophisticated investors are large and they need more capacity. So it's hard for them to be in a product that's going to be less than $1 billion. But the long only strategy, the clients that are invested in that manage more than $100 billion in assets for themselves. So they're very, very large clients that are invested in the long only strategy. So the long only strategy gives us a way to work with more sophisticated, large scale clients. And of course, in terms of assets, it's a more scalable strategy, but then the revenue on the long-only side looks very different from the revenue on the market neutral portfolio. At the same time, I think it's good for us to have a diversified business mix. And so having a range of strategies, I think, just helps diversify the business.
And let me ask you, so your focus on Asia and emerging markets, because you made your name on U.S. small cap active. Have you abandoned that, or was this just the biggest opportunity for the next 10 years back in 2010 when you were thinking about this, right? Because it was, you know, less competition, more retail flows, more inefficiency there, and you would rather compete in that space versus there's so many U.S. small cap strategies. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, my early days at BGI when I was part of the research team, I was part of the Asian equity research team. So I spent a lot of time working on Japan and Asia ex Japan. So my early roots were there, and I just understand those markets because of my background as well. But the interesting thing is that Asia and emerging markets looks very much like the U.S. did in the late 90s and early 2000s. So it's your classic inefficient market, Johnny, where information takes a long time to get priced in. And if you go back and think about the late 90s and the early 2000s, that was U.S. small cap. That was the less efficient part of the market in the U.S. So there were a lot of similarities, but the main reason we chose this space was because I think the opportunity for alpha was much stronger in this space. And we also had confidence that we could deliver strong returns here, that we could adapt our models and adapt our strategies for this market context.
Hindsight is always 20/20, right? Back in 2010, it's just like, oh, we're just going to invest in all the FANG stocks and like U.S. equities, and who knew that quant easing and all this easy money was going to be here forever. So I'm sure the macro environment hasn't been great overall, right? Because the U.S. has just performed so well. But certainly from an alpha perspective, you've proven that out. But it's just more of having that diversified return stream. So you've stuck with your conviction. Can we turn toward starting a business as a woman and your lessons that you've kind of learned there? And think about this from the perspective of some of our audience members that want to start their own funds or that are female, because you joked, you probably worked twice as hard than others to get half as far is the term that you use. Like, talk to me about your experience there.
It is hard, Johnny, but at the same time, it's very, very fulfilling to me. And so in terms of advice, this is why I tell people that early in your career, you just got to explore. And when you find the thing that you have passion for and you can be good at it, that's what gives you the inspiration to do it and to stick with it. So like I said, when I started out, a lot of people told me not to do it, and it has not been easy. We've had a lot of volatility over the last 10 years. But the thing that keeps me going is confidence I have in our investment process, in the team, in knowing that we can do this. So in terms of advice to people, I would say, don't pay a lot of attention to what other people tell you. Because ultimately, what's going to drive success is your conviction in yourself. I think that's point number one. Point number two is the networking thing. We talked about that. And the grit. You just got to outlast other people.
Oh, you would be, or you are, such a great role model for my daughter. Like, yeah, she's 16. She cares so much about what other people think. I'm like, who cares what they think? But they have to come to their own realization of that over time. Because I remember when I was a teenager, that mattered a lot. Like, what you wore, if someone thought you were smart, you were judged. But it does take a certain mindset in doing that. Okay, so let's talk about your overall business now. How many employees do you have in total?
We have 14 people on the team.
14 people based in, are you right in San Francisco proper, right in the city, or you're outside of it?
We're in Foster City, which is a small suburb right outside the San Francisco airport.
Got it. Okay, and talk to me about, so you're almost coming up on your 10-year anniversary, which is amazing, right? Because most hedge funds, so many of them fail, but the average life cycle or lifespan is probably somewhere around 7 years. So you're way on the other side of that. I kind of feel like you're still a startup. You managed to get an amount of money, but you can certainly be a lot bigger as well, too. Keeping your team together, et cetera, because the one thing that I've noticed, which is it kind of bugs me, but that's just the reality. Like if you look post 2020, it's the millennials, the Citadels, those folks that are all like 30, 40 billion, like they're just sucking up all the assets. And it leaves all the little smaller folks in a really difficult situation. It's like, oh, can you hire all the talent? Can you pay competitively? Are you going to be in business and all those things? Even a firm like BlackRock, which is amazing, right? They have all these resources to like buy alternative data, like invest, like just buy people, right? So I'm sure of your employees, there are people knocking on their doors as well, too. So talk to me about the state of the industry and anyone that's like sub 1 billion versus that spot is in a situation where it can be tough as well, too.
Well, that's really interesting. And you're right. The industry has evolved a lot in the last 10 years. Pre-global financial crisis, all this capital was in the hands of the prop desk. And now all this capital is in the hands of these large multi-strat platforms. So it has moved a lot. That said, for us, the thing that has really helped attract and retain talent is our culture, John. There are lots of reasons people don't want to work at the big firms. And I think what differentiates us is the culture here. We are very transparent within the organization. So there's a lot of room to learn. Don't have any silos. There's a lot of room to experiment, try out new ideas. And people have a voice. So at a lot of the big platforms, you're a cog in the wheel. And yes, you get paid well. But that might not be enough for a lot of people. So people that work at Nippon really care about the research. They care about the learning. They want to have a voice. And they want to see their work translate into returns directly. So they want to see that full connection, which I think is harder at a lot of big firms. So I think it's our culture that really keeps us together.
It's a very exciting time at Nippon. Performance is strong. We've scaled assets nicely. But more importantly, the research pipeline is full of innovative ideas. There's always a lot going on in research, but this year we're bringing the research together in two new strategies. The first is an emerging market small cap strategy. As you know, small cap is an high alpha part of the market, and we're excited to be launching something in this space. It really builds upon our core strength of stock selection in emerging markets. And the second strategy we're launching is a gender lens strategy. This strategy is particularly close to my heart, because as you know, promoting diversity, especially with a focus on gender, is something that this industry needs. This strategy will also invest in emerging markets, but with a gender focus. Over time, I hope that more capital will migrate to strategies like this that promote diversity within our industry.
Well, I think you have an extraordinary amount of grit I think your success is you're just scratching the surface. Look, it takes time. It takes perseverance. It takes returns as well. And I'm so glad that you joined us for this AIM High ELI podcast series. And I do hope you come. Well, the AIM National Conference, September 15th, 16th, is in your backyard this year, right? Where our intention is to do it in person. We've got a whole host of folks that have already signed up to come. And if you're available, we'd love to have you at the conference as well, too. It would be a great networking opportunity.
Well. You're going to make me work some more, Johnny. But yes, I'll be there. Thank you for having me.
Well, great. Well, yeah, let's leave it there. And thank you for joining us. Yeah, you're an amazing woman. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more from you going forward. So good luck.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks for listening to AIM High ELI. To learn more about AIM ELI, please visit our website, aim.org, and join our mailing list. That's aaaim.org. AIM welcomes all supporters of diversity as it takes all stakeholders in the ecosystem to make a long-lasting impact for diversity at the senior ranks. If you have suggestions on other guests we should feature on AIM High ELI, or if you are interested in participating, please reach out to kit.canlas@aim.org. That's kit.canlas@aaaim.org or johnny.wu@courtseycap.com. That's johnny.wu@quartzycap.com. Cheers.